Judy was boring.
Hello.
Then Judy discovered Chumbacasino.com.
It's my little escape.
Now Judy's the life of the party.
Oh, baby, mama's bringing home the bacon.
Whoa, take it easy, Judy. The Chumba life is for everybody. So go to Chumbacasino.com and play over 100 casino-style games. Join today and play for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. Chumbacasino.com. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Welcome to the Pakistan Cricket Podcast, episode 21. The History of Pakistani Women's Cricket with Ayush Puthran, hosted by Zainab Rizvi.
Looks like it is recording. So, it's a pleasure to have Ayush, who has written a wonderful book on the history of Pakistani women's cricket, who is joining us from India. And I also have somebody who has actually read the book, unlike myself. So I'm kind of just tagging along here. I'm also sick, so I will mostly be on mute here. She is a regular on the podcast, both as a guest and now quite regularly as a co-host. And today she will be basically the host. So welcome, Zainab.
Hi, Sunny. Thank you. A bit nervous about the first episode that I'm going to completely do. Not completely do, but mostly do myself.
Basically so. Completely do. Yeah, I'm just pressing record essentially. Go ahead. Floor is yours.
Okay. Hi, Ayush. Thank you so much for joining us. Welcome to the Pakistan Cricket Podcast. We are here today to chat about your amazing book, which is called Unveiling Jazba, A History of Pakistan Women's Cricket. So before we do anything else, I'd really like to start off by commending you for this excellent compilation and how you go about your business of narrating not only the stories of the players, but tell us about how the sport itself, women's cricket, evolved in Pakistan, because this is a story that not many fans of cricket in Pakistan, even fans like me, and I consider myself a very involved fan, were not
nerd. I would be nerd.
These were stories that needed to be told, and they're not as well known of. So I hope it's very widely read, and these girls are very inspirational. Their stories should be out there. So thank you for writing this book and writing it so well. I finished the book in two sittings. I could have finished it in one, but I was, if I didn't have work or, I mean, it's written in a very easy to read style. It's like a story. So you're always looking forward to find out what happens next, It's not like a, I know there's history in the title, but it's not like a boring history book. It's like in a story format. So, it's very well written. So, before we go on to discuss about, like some of the things that I found really interesting in the content of the book, I would like to like, just know, how you got into, the business of writing about Pakistan women's cricket, especially your background from India. You do mention at the end of the book that it just came to you one day as you were sitting on your couch. But how did this transpire? What led you to writing this book?
Firstly, thank you, Zainab. Thank you, Sami. For reading the book, I hope it has added value for the next time you ever watch Pakistan women's team. There's something, some sort of a background that you have. So this started out in 2019. I had a broken leg and I was on bed rest. And one of my friends, he had joined the PCB and he was given the responsibilities. Name is S.N. Nagi. And he was given the responsibility to handle the media for the Pakistan women's team. So one day he just approached me. He's like, would you want to talk to the players? I'm like, yeah, more than happy. But I had almost forgotten because I had a broken leg. So I was sort of partying with a lot of friends because they were always coming and meeting me and all of that because I was bored in life. So one day he just called me up and he's like, you wanted to talk, right? So the players are ready in the next half an hour. And I panicked because I didn't know enough about Pakistan women's team. The only time I'd ever seen them play was when they were playing against India. And from 2012 to 2018, every time India and Pakistan played, more or less, they always ran them close. Twice, they even beat them. So I was under the impression that maybe the Pakistani players are just like the Indians, just as good and maybe with similar stories and all of that. So I went to search, because whenever you're interviewing an international cricketer, it is respectful that you know something mm-hmm. about them, that you do your background. But when I went, so I was going to interview five cricketers, Bisma Maru from Lahore, Nida Dar from Gujranwala, Kainat Imtiaz from Karachi, Nahida Khan from Balochistan, and Diana Beck from Gilgit. So it was on me that I sort of researched on them, and there was absolutely nothing available about them on their cricket. So I went and spoke to them like I would talk to these local domestic cricketers in India, like, who are you? What do you do? Where are you from? But when I heard their stories, it was incredibly moving. And it sort of shocked me, because it can't be the story of everyone, because I thought the stories would be similar to that of the Indian cricketers. And with Indian cricketers, almost every interview I've read, every player I've spoken to, it's the same story. My father was interested mm-hmm. in cricket. Or my brother, I used to play with my brother. That's how I got into cricket. But with Pakistani players, it was almost like they're hiding from their own brothers, their fathers, sometimes even their mothers, their neighbors, and playing. And these are cricketers who have reached the international level. So imagine those who could never even make it to the international level. What would their stories be like? So that is sort of something that fascinated me. And the very fact, so the point of this book was to document stories of their cricket, each and every game that they've played. But it was almost impossible to tell the stories of what happened on the field without telling what was going on beyond this. So I had to, like, the first half is literally trying to just give a background of what was going on behind the scenes, to explain why teams are winning, teams are losing, how this team is growing through the years. So yeah, that is how it started for me.
Fascinating.
Absolutely. Building on of that about your preparation for the interviews and your interviews itself. So you mentioned that some players were on board immediately, but you also mentioned in the book that one of the pioneers of the game in Pakistan, Shazia Khan, was not initially on board, and it took her a while to be convinced. But obviously, narrating the story of Pakistan, how Pakistan women's cricket came to be, became that much easier when she agreed. So if you could talk a little bit about how difficult or easy it was in general to get players comfortable enough to talk about their journeys, and especially talk about some of the conflicts that they have with each other, their personality clashes, and how did you build trust with them? Like, basically, how do you interview well? That's what I'm trying to learn here.
So, yes, the first cricketer I spoke to, and the one who agreed to help me out with this, for 3 years after that, she never responded to any of my emails, to my calls, after agreeing to come on board. So, yeah, that became difficult. It took me at least, say, around 7 to 8 months for the first cricketer to talk to me. And that was, I think, Kiran Baloch. And that trust came from a journalist by the name Afia Salam. She was possibly the oldest, the first woman sports journalist of Pakistan. And she trusted me, and she was the one who sort of spoke to Shaiza and Kiran. So Kiran Baloch, of course, was the first person to open up. So she told me the entire story. And even because she's extremely close to Shaiza, so she told me the entire story. I did have the entire story. But by the time I reached to Shaiza, it was 1 month before my submission deadline that Shaiza agreed to speak, because of which I had to cancel a lot of interviews. I'm like, no, everyone aside, I have to speak to Shaiza right now. And it took 2 years of convincing Shaiza. It took 1.5 years of convincing Sana Mir to talk to me. But the other cricketers, those who were contracted with PCB, they, of course, came on board much easily. And I think with each passing player, the trust developed, and I could sort of see that the good side of it, and even the negatives of my interviews. Like, after a point, all the cricketers would come and tell me, listen, I have to go out after half an hour, 45 minutes. Because I had this tendency of having these really long 2-hour, 4-hour long interviews and all of that. So you know that they're exchanging notes. But it was that much easier with each passing player that trust was coming through. Initially, it was difficult because, yes, you are a guy from India. Why do you want to interview us? Because I don't know how many journalists in Pakistan actually interview them about their cricket. So, yes, I mean, I'll tell you with Jaweria Khan, Jerry, as she's known, that interview, 1 hour into the interview, I was talking over the phone. That Zoom call was over the phone and I was recording it on my laptop on this online portal or whatever it is called, online voice recorder. And 1 hour into the interview, I lost my internet. So the entire recording is lost.
Oh,
sorry, Jaweria,
oh.
If you're listening to this. But yeah, and then it's embarrassing too because Jaweria is possibly the most entertaining speaker, the most entertaining storyteller. She's extremely witty. So even if I get the information, I'll not get the details of how she sort of described situations and all of that. So yes, there were a few bloopers, technical bloopers that happened. But yes, I think it became easier with each passing player, with each passing journalist. A lot of them came on board much outside the realm of Pakistan cricket itself. Somebody like Munize Jahangir, who has nothing to do with cricket, but she was somebody who could guide me in a lot of places related to the politics, to the culture, to history. So, yes, and Ehsan was sort of the backbone of this entire project because he was the one who helped me get in touch with a lot of people, whether it's within cricket, outside of that. That helped. And over the years, of course, I was writing for CricBuzz on Pakistan women's cricket. So the kind of stories that were coming through were also sort of, I don't know, hopefully building some trust and faith with the players. So that is how I went about this entire
thing. Can I just ask a quick follow-up? You said Jaweria was like a really entertaining sort of character. And could you give us some stories for somebody who, you know, I haven't interacted with her personally. So I'm kind of curious what sort of, what's her wit like or what some stories you have from talking to her?
It's extremely difficult to explain her humor because it is firstly very smart. So you don't know when it's going to come and strike you. She's talking to you seriously. There's one line and it changes the mood. You talk to her about the centuries and she'll just go about how sad that day was. She is a very good storyteller. So she has this knack of, you know, if it's a bad moment, she'll somehow make it funny. I remember she was telling me about the story of being in New Zealand and there's an earthquake that's happening and rocking. And she's nicely trying to put her towel to dry, taking the phone out of charge instead of running down because the building might collapse anytime. She's in some 19th floor or something. And just the way she does it, it is natural to her. It's difficult to explain, but it is very smart, sometimes dry. There's a lot of sarcasm that comes through. I mean, a natural storyteller. Absolutely natural.
Oh, great. Would love to interview her sometime. Sorry, Zainab, go ahead.
Yeah, that was a very interesting story that that you mentioned in the book as well about how the players coped with the earthquake in New Zealand. So one of the people that you didn't get to interview was Uruj and now I'll do a bit of storytelling here myself. So Uruj is as we all know is like a dentist, and the dental college she went into, I went to the same dental college. So I'm not a dentist, but I studied for 1 year in that same college. I hated dentistry, so I quit. But at that time, I was beginning to blog, and there was my blog had a small readership. But and her mother, Dr. Azmat Mumtaz, was our family dentist. So there was a Times journalist or some English journalist who wanted to reach out to a Pakistani cricketer, and they emailed me because I was a blogger, and I was like, okay, I can give you the phone number of my dentist, maybe that's how you can reach them. I read the book and I was thinking about Uruj. So she since She was a part of that early period. She was a captain, but then she quit to focus on her studies, and then she came back, and she was kind of in a similar role to Misbah. She was on a lot of different roles together on the cricket committee and the coach. So how I guess, of course, you were disappointed, but how difficult was it to narrate that story of the evolution of Pakistan women's cricket without having her perspective on it?
Extremely difficult because I remember that there are three characters who really divided opinions. One was Shaiza, one was Sana, and one was Uruj. So there was a point I had the entire story with me, but these were the three people who didn't speak to me, and three big characters not speaking to me. And especially when they're dividing opinions. So Sana did speak to me eventually, 1.5 years down the line. Shaiza spoke to me 2 years down the line. Uruj didn't. So that is why there is a disclaimer right at the start that everything that is said about Uruj, her version doesn't exist. So her version either doesn't exist or has been taken from secondary sources, other interviews or write-ups that she's written. So yes, it is extremely difficult. I mean, because she's a huge, huge figure in Pakistan cricket's evolution, even then, even now. And these are people who are really dividing opinions. They're strong characters by themselves, have played a huge part in the story of Pakistan cricket. As much as it was necessary that I get Uruj on board, I did speak to her. Their emails, their phone calls, their messages, everything is there. But she didn't agree, and it's beyond me after a point. So not the best thing for the story, but I did try, and she did know I was writing this book. So if it's, I mean, players' right to not speak, so it's on.
Absolutely. I was just curious, you said they divide opinion. Could you explain what you mean by that? Like, what are the sort of strong opinions about them? Just to give us a clue about that.
See, most of the Pakistani cricketers, as Sana Mir would say, and you'd actually figure that out even if you talk to others in the setup, there is a tendency or a need to be the stereotypical good girl. So they'll not pick up fights, they'll not get into arguments. If somebody's shouting, they'll just put their heads down, lower their eyes, and probably cry. Some of them do cry. They're not people who get into friction or take things head on, which was not the case with the Shaiza. He would fight. Sana would fight. Uruj is in the center of a lot of mess throughout. So her version was important, that we can't just take somebody else's version and just write about that. There was a case in 2005 or 6. There was a match between Lahore and Karachi, and after which Shaiza, Kiran Baloch, your trendsetters of Pakistan cricket, the trailblazers, they left the game because they suspected that, say, Sana Mir and Uruj Mumtaz sort of underperformed. Now, in this regard, Sana Mir gave her point of view. If there is a Rosha Monick situation, Sana Mir gave her point of view. There were other cricketers who came to give Sana Mir's point of view as well. And Sana Mir, I mean, that was the point. You know, even when Sana Mir didn't speak to me, there were a lot of people coming and talking about Sana Mir for Sana Mir and defending her at all times, which didn't happen with an Uruj Mumtaz. Even with Shaiza, at least there was one Kiran Baloch who would just defend her till the end, which wasn't the case with Uruj Mumtaz. So that was an issue. Even when Sana Mir was dropped from the side, Bisma Maruf has made her stand clear that, listen, I wanted her. It was not my choice to drop her. So then the entire focus goes on Uruj Mumtaz. And because there was always this friction between Sana and Uruj, it was important to find out why Uruj took certain decisions, what was her reasoning behind all of this, which was happening for every other cricketer or even administrators. There were people who were, even if they were saying something negative about somebody else, there was a positive side to it as well. Uruj, except for the Indian cricketers, yeah, there were some Indian cricketers who absolutely loved Uruj, but their experience with her was limited. There were not too many people from the Pakistani setup defending her, so that was an issue.
Interesting.
Yes.
Thank you. Sorry, Zainab, go ahead.
Yeah, I was gonna say that you'll have to read the book to find out. I don't want to give like the spoiler and tell the whole story. So in asking the questions, I was mindful to like keep some of those bits intact of the story and just like give out enough to get the conversation going.
Sorry, couldn't help it.
So personally, for me, the most intriguing part of like how the game in Pakistan evolved was how it went on from basically being almost an amateur sport, being under the patronage of Shazia, her sister, and their very rich family from very elite class backgrounds, to a very gradual process where they had to relinquish their power and as the BCB formally took control of the game. And from there, it spread to, you know, the hinterlands of the country where today you have cricketers from Balochistan, Chaman, and, you know, Gilgit, Diana, and all parts of Pakistan, the hinterlands of the country coming. So, again, Ayush, this may be like asking you to summarize the whole book, but would you like to unpack for our listeners how the culture of the team has evolved, like from 96 to right now, in terms of where the players are coming from, what's the environment like around the team, how has that, like, from the how the sport has become more mainstream in sort of like, if you could synthesize that for us.
What amuses me, so for those who don't know, women's cricket was run by a different board before, say, 2005 across the world. It came under IWCC, which later merged with ICC in 2005. So in every country, whether it's Pakistan, whether it is India, wherever, Australia, it was run by a separate body altogether. And one very interesting thing, whether it's in India or even in Pakistan, you'd find a lot more media coverage of women's cricket when before it merged with, say, a PCB or a BCCI. Even before it came under BCCI, there are traces of matches happening in front of 40,000 odd people, 50,000 odd people in India. Even in Pakistan, it's a lot easier to find coverage of Shaiza Khan's team than PCB's team, which sort of amuses me, maybe because it was run by few people. They took the responsibility of ensuring that people come in, there's more media coverage, rather than the tokenism that's happening with these boards, where they know, okay, men's cricket is what's going to get us money and our entire focus is there. So that always happened. But once it came under PCB, of course, they had more of a structural reach because there was already reach to, say, the Rawalpindis, Multans, and other parts of Pakistan via men's cricket. So they could take the structures there. And of course, Shaiza Khan, now she was extremely rich, as you know, Zainab just explained. They had a carpet factory. So back then, they were running cricket out of their own pockets, touring New Zealand, spending around, I don't know, 20 lakh odd rupees in 1997. To not just take themselves, but the entire team, their kit bags, their passports, visas, and everything. But after a point of time, the moment it came under PCB, now you'll find, interestingly, you pick up any of the top cricketers. I mean, even now, cricket is centered around Karachi and Lahore. That is where the structures largely are for women cricketers. But if you see the top cricketers, where are they coming from? Nida Dash, she's from Gujranwala. Alia Riaz is from Rawalpindi. Diana Beg is from Gilgit. There is Nahida Khan coming from Balochistan. There's a very, very interesting Aisha Naseem. She is one, along with Fatima Sana, the future of Pakistan cricket. All right. You've not had a batter like her. She comes from Abbottabad, but she is largely brought up in Karachi. Okay. She now has the comfort of coming through the Karachi ranks. But she tells one very interesting thing. She's like, if I continue playing from Karachi, I won't make any difference. The moment I go to Abbottabad and families there see that a girl is playing, maybe that will normalize it for them to send their daughters to play. And they're making a lot more difference than just coming out on the field and whacking a few sixes or taking a few wickets. So this is the current fabric of the Pakistan team, that it is spreading across, and you'll see people, Saba Nazir, again, I don't want to divulge too many details about her life. It's incredible the kind of battles she has fought just to be able to play. And people coming from lower income backgrounds, from rural areas, distant lands where you know, there are times certain players can't make it for practice because, well, there is some blast somewhere or the weather conditions have changed. Or, you know, now the flight is not taking off from there and all of that. So, yes, there is a huge change in terms of just the diversity of players that have come into the setup. They're no more just from, you know, people from army backgrounds or people from fairly well-to-do financially families. Yeah,
the Sabha is the girl that repeatedly suffered from typhoid, right? So her story was really one of the many inspiring stories in the book, how she used to bike for 1.5 hours from her hostel to get to the ground. It was like one of my favorite stories from the book. And you talk about the diversity and how the sport has spread. And so building off of that, I think it's important because this was one of my biggest takeaways from the book, in terms of like how there are, the attitudes towards, the idea of women playing cricket and how they have evolved. So, my takeaway was that it can be inaccurate and even maybe even unhelpful to characterize those as, just like binary, that either they're encouraged or discouraged. So, you know, as with women's participation in other aspects of public and social life in Pakistan, they tend to be impacted by lots of other variables apart from gender, like your social class, your ethnicity, and so on. So, and all of these different social vectors can, you know, overlap and intersect as people's subjectivity around their idea of women playing sport pans out. So would you agree that it's not like binary, and how would you describe, like, how has the situation evolved? Do you think it's more, and I'd like to think it's more favorable now, for the societal attitudes have evolved, it's got better, but you know, we can't narrate the story of women's cricket in Pakistan without saying that yes, it's generally not conducive, but there is more to it.
Yeah, of course, it's not binary, and I would be the worst person as a man in India sitting and, I don't know, making that judgment. So it is in Sanami's words. Sanami probably puts it across, like you said, in the last few paragraphs of the introduction chapter itself, that it is not about mean men all the time. Yes, there are people who are trying to control and all of that, but largely it is like families have to take the responsibility of what the society is going to throw at them. So for a father to know that your daughter is going to go and be in a place where they're not going to be proper beds, proper food, and all of that, would you want your daughter to go through that? And other, a lot of other social factors that Sanami talks about. So it is, yes, it is far more complex. And especially because I was initially writing this for the UK audience, because that is where my publisher was. So to put it down for them, that it is not as simple as you can see it, because yes, in the subcontinent, we know the number of challenges that can come. And it is not just about a father encouraging the daughter or discouraging, like you rightly said. So yes, I mean, I put it in Sanami's words, as she said it, because I can't be the one making that judgment sitting here in India, especially as a man, to understand those challenges. So that's why you'd see the book is entirely filled with a lot of quotes and quotes and quotes and quotes, instead of what our usual style of writing should be, wherein the author has to bring his own ideas into a book. I stayed away from it in this. But I completely agree with you, Zainab.
Yeah, and as we keep hearing from the stories that come out of the Pakistan men's team, some of these challenges, even we heard that how Haris Rauf's father discouraged him from playing. It's people want a secure livelihood. It's not often clear. Even with men's cricket, if people are going to make it to the top flight. So it's that much out in the gray for women's cricket. So it's it can be very easy to just paint that, you know, Pakistani society doesn't want, is not conducive for women to playing cricket. Yes, it's not, but there is a lot more to it. And I'm glad that it came out from the way you narrated the stories. So moving on to some of the cricket the players play themselves. So I think it would be disservice not to talk a little bit more about Sana Amir, and because she's arguably, I mean, I shouldn't even say arguably, she's probably the best, greatest Pakistan women's cricket ever. She became the first player to achieve like number one in the ODI rankings. She has two Asian medals. I mean, I was like, why don't we celebrate? When I finished reading the book, I was like, why don't enough people know this? I mean, I should have known this, so can we talk more about her, legacy? And would you say, this is like a very specific question, that her tenure as captain and that period between 2008 and 14 when they won two medals and, you know, they beat India. That was perhaps the, so far, the highest point of Pakistan's women's cricket history.
Yes, maybe yes. And her legacy, again, you know, that it's very interesting, because a lot of people say, yes, Sana Amir had it easy. She could just, you know, walk out and say, I want to play, and she got a chance to play, which wasn't the case with a lot of other players. But at the same time, when you speak to the players and the coaches, and everybody is saying one thing, that Sana Amir made me feel comfortable. And even now, as late as Fatima Sana, who's come through, she didn't know if there was a Pakistan women's team. All she knew was there was a Sana Amir. That she's the only player she knew of. I know of international cricketers from other countries who have played against Pakistan, who do commentary on Pakistan team, know of no one except Sana Amir. This is the case with a lot of other people who say that, yes, they follow Pakistan women's cricket, they support them, but they can't name more than five cricketers. And Sana Amir is the first cricketer that comes to mind. Mm-hmm. So yes, Sana Amir sort of brought cricket to the front pages. She brought this awareness, because again, a lot of players would tell you that they did not know of the existence of women's cricket, a women's cricket team. Sabah Nazir would tell you she didn't know that girls could even play. They're even allowed to play. So the moment you see these photos and these players, these achievements, and they're coming on the front pages when India beats Pakistan, or they're winning the gold medal. Again, that gold medal was probably not a great cricketing achievement, because they beat teams like China and Thailand and Bangladesh. But it brought cricket to the front pages, because no other Pakistani team across sporting disciplines won a gold medal. So Sana Amir made these girls who didn't have the kind of confidence, didn't have the kind of comfort, she shielded them, and also, of course, popularized the sport. So yes, the legacy of Sana Amir is far, far beyond what we can understand. And that's why I Pakistan cricket is extremely lucky to have her. They probably don't realize it. I mean, we see a lot of times with men's cricket, all the chopping, changing, all the fights, and God knows all that happens. And you'll see that, you know, in other teams, that a captain is just the captain on the field. Sana Amir gave them a space within that field to feel comfortable, where they were seeing people like them who had fought through the kind of challenges that they did, because they were not seeing that around where they were staying. It's only at the ground in Lahore or Karachi where they would all assemble, they would find people like them. And Sana Amir became that leader, a very natural leader. And Pakistan cricket is extremely lucky to have her. So, yes, there was a legacy she created. But, yes, the other criticism is she had it easy, because she came from the camp. But, again, that's not her fault. So, yeah.
I mean, you can't hold somebody's, like, privilege against them. Then, you know, why were you privileged? And even in her privilege, she had to convince her father. And it was not simple. It was probably her struggles were not as pronounced as the others, but the way she embraced that role of like almost like a mother figure for the team, I was so touching. She even coached. I read that she even like she was even coaching the players on their studies, like because the parents were concerned about you know, them missing out on their education, and what if they're not good, they don't end up being, you know, big in cricket. So she was even tutoring them. So even
from Bisma Mali in 2005 to Fatima Sana in 2019. Like Sana Amir has been a teacher for almost all the players who have graduated from the team.
It's amazing.
Step into the world of power, loyalty, and luck.
I'm gonna make him an offer he can't refuse.
With family, cannolis, and spins mean everything.
Now, you wanna get mixed up in the family business.
Introducing The Godfather at ChumbaCasino.com. Test your luck in the shadowy world of The Godfather slot.
Someday, I will call upon you to do a service for me.
Play The Godfather now at ChumbaCasino.com.
Welcome to the family.
VGW Group, no purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions 18 plus.
Judy was boring.
Hello.
Then Judy discovered ChumbaCasino.com.
It's my little escape.
Now Judy's the life of the party.
Oh, baby, mama's bringing home the bacon.
Whoa, take it easy, Judy. The Chumba life is for everybody. So go to ChumbaCasino.com and play over 100 casino-style games. Join today and play for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. ChumbaCasino.com. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Yeah. So moving on from that, like I heard you last week speak about this in another, I don't know if it was a podcast or just a discussion, but I heard that clip where you talked about the disparities in pay between Pakistani female cricketers and other top cricketers around the world, even in compared to other cricketers in the region. So, I was wondering, you know, apart from like the PCB providing them better contracts, because obviously better financial returns would incentivize more people to take up the sport. I wondered if there's a possibility for Pakistani players participate in leagues abroad. There are only, like, to my knowledge, there is only the Women's Big Bash League and there's a Women's 100. And Nida Dar has featured, I think, for one season in the Women's for Sydney Thunder. So perhaps, you know, that I was really looking forward to it last year if Pakistanis would feature in the 100 women's players, but they weren't. I guess there's a skill gap and these are very elite competitions, but I'd like to think that, you know, somebody like a Bisma Maroof or Javeria or you know, Nida has played for the BBL. She would have managed to increase her pay retainer by playing one of these contracts, and whether PCB can do to incentivize these other leagues to hire Pakistani players, you know, something along the lines of, you know, the MOU that exists between Lahore Qalandar and Yorkshire, where they exchange players. So how do you see as ways where we could generally incentivize better financial returns for the women's team?
See, doing that with a foreign league is extremely difficult because every team has like two openings. So if you have like six teams or eight teams, you're talking about 12 to 16 mm-hmm. players. And if you're picking 12 to 16 players from other countries, if they really want the cream of the lot, it's very difficult that they'll reach till Pakistan. And if PCB really wants to do something, they'll have to fix the issues inside their house and not look elsewhere mm-hmm. for help. And that won't be possible, because even when there was an opening, I don't think Pakistani cricketers have strong enough agents to even coordinate all these movements. The first time Nida went there, there was some help with Andy Richards, who was the coach of Pakistan team. But the kind of networking, I've experienced this. PCB is not doing enough to even reach out to these leagues when there were openings. But having said that, you can't depend on overseas leagues to fix your problems. This has to happen in-house, and it has to begin with a lot of things. It starts from, like, you'll see what are the motivations for in every story that you listen of these cricketers. What were the motivations? At what point did the parents agree and said, okay, fine, play? A majority of the time, it is either because you're photo has come in the newspapers, which is sort of, you know, neighbors are happy, it feels like you've achieved some mm-hmm. success, and there is an upward social mobility of sorts in that sense, or when they are earning money, they're bringing home money, which is much needed, which otherwise the rest of the family members are not able to get. So the moment you cut down your domestic structure to 45 players and the rest are unable to bring in that sort of money, it is a natural demotivator for parents if you're not in that top 45. parents are not going to let you just play, you know, a year and let's see whether you can come next year and get into that top 45. So they need to expand that pool. They've removed departments from the structure because departments were hiring these cricketers and they were giving them permanent jobs. I think even now ZTBL is still paying the cricketers who were on board with them earlier. So financial incentive is a reality. You can't run away from that, especially in our countries. I mean, sports is not a profession that is, whether it's for boys, whether it's for girls, even for guys, they won't just let you play if you're not earning money. It's very difficult in India or in Pakistan. And even more so with women, because like in India, with men's cricket, yes, livelihood is your basic criteria why parents sort of demotivate you to not get into sports. They'll tell you, okay, you know, concentrate on academics and all of that. We don't have that culture where sports is promoted. While for women, that is an issue. Plus, there are 100 more issues.
Societal pressures.
So
marriage, kids.
Multiple. Yes. So it is for men, if it's one issue, for women, it's one plus many more. So that financial incentive is a huge deal to change minds, to give hope, to bring more cricketers into the setup. Because right now, whether or not, whatever the issue is, there is a lack of women coming through to play cricket or any sport for that matter. It's not just an issue with Pakistan, it's an issue with India as well. Within the subcontinent, we just don't have that culture. So financial incentive is a huge motivator. Now, if you see Indian cricketers, they are earning what? Again, as I mentioned that day, one test match, 45 lakh for playing 4 days of cricket. If you can see yourself there, and especially those who are good enough, they know that to reach to the top is that much easier. If you say, find somebody like an Aisha Naseem, if you're good enough to hit like that, you know you'll get into the Pakistani team today or tomorrow. But if there is no financial incentive either, why would anybody want you to go through the kind of struggles that they're going through? I mean, I mentioned in the book, I have said it several times, till 2018 World Cup, there were girls who were skipping meals during the World Cup just so that they can save some money and take it back home. If that is how you're going to turn up on the field to play against Australia, England or any other country, you're never going to win. And the kind of coaches are changing every other day. Like, you need, because these cricketers come raw into the international setup, because there's no structure at the domestic level. It's a very weak setup. So there they're trained and honed. So you need coaches for longer periods. They keep firing coaches even when they're doing a good job. They're delivering results. Mark Coles is a prime example. He did everything that was expected and more. The team was happy with him. He was delivering results. Yet now, if the management, the board has an issue over whatever differences that they had, if you're going to sack him, then if a new coach is going to come every 2 years, that's going to be an issue. I know Ramiz Raja likes these three-month coaches. Yeah.
Zainab loves a bit of Ramiz slander, so you just made her day.
Oh my God, the point in the story where Ayush wrote about how Ramiz wrote to the West Indies Cricket Board and told them behind the back of the Women's Cricket Board at the time that they shouldn't tour Pakistan, my blood was literally boiling. I mean, he had his explanations and reasons, but it was, and he has since come around to, like, he's done things for women's cricket. He was the one who increased the salary retainers in his current state, but it was still like, I mean, I was like pretty shocked that the way he went about rationalizing it, and it was, he didn't like say, okay, I shouldn't have done that. He still like had his reasons. He was justifying it that, you know, there had to be one board and so on and so forth. But it was really, that was a serious point for me in the book where I was like, what on earth? But,
well, credit to him for admitting to it. I was so surprised. I put him that question immediately. He's like, yeah, I did that, but these were my reasons why I did it. Like, thank you, Ramiz. I mean, very honest of him to be doing that. But yeah, again, these are like personal equations, but that is where all these personal vendettas, when they have come together, that is what has stopped the progress or sort of slowed down the progress of women's cricket. if they can keep their personal differences aside, which is sort of human, but maybe things would have been better.
Can I just have one quick question about Ramiz? You know, this you may not have an answer for this, and I definitely don't want you to reveal any particular names because I don't want to put anybody out, obviously, and neither would you. But what is the impression generally within the women's team, maybe about Ramiz as PCB chairman? What is the general impression you get?
So, I mean, by the time I was done with my research, Ramiz hadn't joined as the chairman back then. So I'd done all my research when Ehsan Mani and Waseem Khan were there as head. So there was nothing about Ramiz. Ramiz was the CEO of Pakistan Cricket in around 2004 for 6 months. And that is where he wrote the letter also. Okay. So he still made an impact and Shai's absolutely.
What about Waseem Khan? What about Waseem Khan and Ehsan Mani?
Not sure about Ehsan Mani, nothing that came out. But Waseem Khan was highly respected. I mean, the kind of things that happened during his tenure probably wouldn't have happened. His tenure sort of accelerated the developments at a lower level. But yes, I mean, his hands were tied probably to cut it down to 45 player domestic tournament. But the parental policy came under Waseem Khan, which many believe had Waseem Khan not been there, probably that would have never come. There was a significant pay hike across, like, not match fees and all, but the retainers and other factors like daily allowances and all of that. So Waseem Khan did have a positive impact on women's
cricket.
And Ehsan Mani also did, by the way. Ehsan Mani did genuinely try to improve women's cricket. I know that for a fact. It didn't work out, but he was trying. This is something that even Shaiza told me. But eventually, again, he fell into a situation where he ended up having Uruj Mumtaz for every role that you could find for cricket, which wasn't the best thing, but he had tried. So full credit to him for that.
He tried to bring Shazia back, right? But they didn't agree. I think you're right. I agree with that assessment that there was a lot of, because that's when I've started following the team a little bit more. So there is a lot of genuine goodwill and intent around that time just to like make women's cricket a priority, focus on its development. They were a little bit unlucky that COVID happened, so some of the things that they planned out didn't work. I was looking forward to the English women's team coming to Pakistan for those T20 international. The men's team came, but nobody has even talked about the women's tour.
I did. In that book, why did the women's team not turn up? Nobody spoke about it. The men's team came up with a ridiculous explanation as to why they don't want to come to Pakistan last year. But the women's team was supposed to come. Why didn't they turn up? And nobody even bothered to question it, not even the Pakistan Cricket Board. That is where, you know, nobody, there's absolutely no priority for this. It just signals that quite obviously.
Yes, that's true. And this was kind of like my next question that, you know, this is more about not just the PCB, but in the region, you know, BCCI has a lot of money, and this is something that they've talked about, that they want to start a women's PSL. Ramiz talks about it. It's almost like it's become a contest that who makes the taller claims. But they've been saying about these things for a couple of seasons now, but it hasn't materialized. And I'm now at that point where I think these are empty promises. And if I don't really get the feel that these two boards have really like made it priority that they want to focus on women's cricket in the same way that they focus on the men's team. It's just, you know, something that's good for the optics when they do well, okay, you know. So do you think we've had that kind of leadership or just the vision right now where we are prioritizing women's cricket on the on some footing, let alone equal footing as the men's teams?
Clearly, I mean, they know, I mean, even now, Ramiz Raja announced there's going to be a women's PSL. Very quietly, they sent a press release that it's going to be a women's league. There's no mention of PSL in the last email. So I don't know if a PSL is even happening. I am quite updated with the scene in India, and I'm quite sure it's happening. But yes, I mean, it's kind of obvious, you know, everybody wants to have that image, that optics, that they are the ones, the forward thinking people within the cricket fraternity, and to put it out. And now, I mean, it's becoming quite obvious with Australia. It's been, what, 8 seasons now of WBBL, 100 has moved ahead. CPL has come up with a women's league. So they can't, especially countries like India and Pakistan, can't afford to stay behind. India is already behind, but high time this comes up. And I mean, some insane money is projected for now. Let's see how that pans out. But yes, I mean, clearly it is a battle of images, which has always been the case.
So I hope you're like not short on time or anything. I just have like a couple of more questions. Yes. And I'm moving towards a conclusion, I promise. So this next question is like, it's my pet peeve on people on Twitter who primarily follow the men's sport. But, you know, when World Cups come around and there's some, the women's team somehow gain some public, they come into the public consciousness. So this is my request to you to like educate these people, because when they see the team play, because now sometimes the teams get televised and so on. So they come out with their excessively harsh criticism of the player's skills level and the team's results overall. So, of course, it comes from a place of ignorance, not knowing the structural limitations and all the hindrances that the players have to cope with to even just play. So, you know, given that, you know, the first central contracts were only awarded in 2010 and the first fitness coach ever for the women's team was only hired in 2018. The first batting coach was also hired the same year. So how do you think in terms of skill and talent and training, how Pakistan fares compared to the top sides like England and Australia and even regional sides like India? Is it really fair to expect our girls to outperform these sides when we have such a limited talent pool of players, so few resources allocated to improving their situation, so little infrastructure and all the inconducive socio-cultural environment? So, you know, how should a fan following Pakistan's women's cricket team, what should their outlook be towards the team?
I don't know about what the outlook should be, because, yeah, it's entertainment. I mean, yeah, it's sort of a bit of a put-off. I can give information, it's on them to read it really and educate themselves or whatever, I don't know. But the thing is, I mean, it's a no match in terms of the kind of facilities they get, the kind of coaching they get, the kind of grounds, the kind of money to even get the bats, and it's not even a match with the Australians. They don't even have the same number of bats. Forget about the quality of those bats. They're not getting that nutrition. Forget about nutrition. As I mentioned, they're not even getting three meals. They're not even having three meals and going to the ground all the time. So there is no chance. I mean, it amazes me. It has amazed me for a long time, the fact that Pakistan is even among the top 8 countries in the world today, given the kind of structural and social and financial limitations that they have to deal with to be where they are, to even beat India. They beat India recently. It's not a chance. Like I mentioned, even in that talk today, an Indian cricketer will earn playing just one test match, earn more than what a Pakistani cricketer will earn by playing an entire year. All the domestic cricket matches, all the international matches, all the retainers, everything put together. It is that wide and big a gulf today. So unless you're comparing it with Bangladeshis, who also get paid better than the Pakistani cricketers, there is no match in terms of that. So fans, I don't know, are they really, I don't know if they're fans, but it's just like they're representing Pakistan. So if they were fans, they would have probably known what is going on and they would have seen them perform and all of that. Because a lot of them just turn up after the match is over. If they've beaten a big team, they'll come to celebrate. If they've lost to a smaller team, they'll come to thrash them. Because they just think they must be as good as the Pakistani men's team are. And I wouldn't blame them, because before learning, I also assume they're probably just as good and have the same kind of issues that Indian cricketers have. It's not the same. And I also learned that through educating myself by talking to these cricketers and understanding their world, life and everything else. So, yes, I mean, I don't have any advice to give to any fans, but yeah.
There's indirectly, no you just did, basically.
Yeah, I'll add that people really need to educate themselves and keep their expectations in check. Like, we're a very young teams in terms of where we are in our history. So even if we were to pump in like a lot of money into the system, it would still take like 5 years, 6 years, at least from where I'm seeing it, for the results of that to start showing up, like in terms of like titles and so on. Because of all the structural issues there exist. So we really need to be patient and like take whatever the team does, you know, and build from there. So, you know, to conclude, our discussion, I think the jazba side of these 83 women who have represented Pakistan, you know, it unveils itself in the way they basically defied the odds to play. I mean, the fact that there is a team and they are playing is their biggest achievement. So any victory of sorts, anything they do on the field after that is a bonus. That's how I see it. So to wrap it up, if I could ask you to like make one final pitch for your book and for our listeners and remind them where they can buy the book from if they want to, how they can buy it.
I am terrible at pitching this, but yeah, this is... If you want any information on Pakistan women's cricket and their first 25 years of their playing days, it is available in this book. It is some stunning, stunning stories. I mean, not because I wrote it, because these players went through what they did to be able to play for Pakistan. It's available everywhere globally except in Pakistan, I guess. Unfortunately, I don't have publishers there, but... Yeah, if you're in US, you're in Canada, you're in UK, you're in India, you're in Australia, wherever you are, on Amazon, it's there. And also at a lot of local bookstores in UK, in India, and a lot of places, yeah.
Are you in talks with any Pakistani publishers, like independent publishers? Are they sort of, is there any interest? I mean, there must be, right?
Yes, there is an interest, but yeah, the documents and all the signings are yet to be done. So hopefully it's happening soon, in a few months. But yes, Pakistan was the toughest to crack because the readership was very low. They were telling that not a lot of people read, and especially on women's cricket. Had it been men's cricket, maybe it would have been easier, I guess. But
at least the libraries, yeah, libraries in the big cities should at least, you know, get copies so that people can rent. You know, even if they're not going to have it at the either way, because I know.
And there's some. Between India and Pakistan, so books can't even go from India to Pakistan. I can't even give the book to someone. So yeah, that is an issue. Zainab, how did you find the book?
I love the book. I mean, I have to tell you, like I said, it was written in a narrative style. So it was not like a boring history book of like, oh, this happened and this happened and this happened. And the way the stories of the players came across, it was really touching and moving and I think these stories need to go out and they need to be heard. And I was like, especially, you know, the early part, how, for example, they fled to New Zealand to play that test and they got the, people were actively trying to stop them and they ran across to another airport in Karachi. There was like a drama, like there was like a tension building up and it was like, I was like, this could be turned into a really nice movie or something. And I hope someday, you know, somebody's sits down, because that has, you know, in popular culture, I you know, there's been Dangal and Chak De India and so on. So the story of women playing sport when it as you just said, there's not many people that read in India and Pakistan, is in Pakistan, especially on women's cricket. So I hope if there's any producers out there or anything, please get in touch with Ayush and you know, this has the potential to be turned into a really good movie, even about how the story
We should get a clip of this and just tag every producer in Pakistan you can think of. Just like, sort of, just spam them. But Thank you so much to both of you.
Thank you.
Ayush, I haven't read the book yet, as I said. I really want to read the book. I will read the book. I will order it. Luckily, I'm not in Pakistan, so I can get it, the copy. Thank you so much, Zainab, for reading the book, for coming up with all the questions, for asking the questions during the interview. Hopefully the podcast will come out sometime soon. And I hope people listen to it, but more importantly, I hope they get the book. And even more importantly, I hope a publisher in Pakistan gets the book so that people can, because there are, you know, there may not be a huge market, but, you know, we know the people already, like Iman or Alvina, Hijab, I'm sure all of them, and not just women, you know, there are a lot of people who want to read the book. And you've got some great endorsements. I saw Usman Samiuddin and others have endorsed it as well. So if people need any more convincing, I hope after listening to this podcast, they will jump and get the book. So thank you so much, Zainab. Thank you so much, Ayush. Take care.
Thank you,
Sami. Love talking to you guys.
Thank you. This was a really fun conversation. Thank you, Ayush.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. Before I finish, I just want to say thank you to Dikobe for letting me use his music. You can donate to my Patreon page if you would like to help me in continuing to do these podcasts. Links with information about the guests, the music, and the Patreon page can be found in the podcast description. Thank you.
Sports Social Podcast Network.